This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the war is over, the United States and the Arab countries seem to agree that there can be no lasting peace in the Middle East until the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is resolved. My guest Amos Oz is one of Israel's leading novelists and essayists, and he's a founding member of Peace Now, a group that supports the creation of a Palestinian state. The last time we spoke, it was a couple of days after the first Scud attack on Tel Aviv. We'd called Oz at his home in the Negev Desert. Today, Oz is in New York for the U.S. publication of his novel, To Know a Woman. This morning, I asked him what his mood is now that the war is over.
Relatively optimistic and obviously very relieved. I assumed it was not going to be a very short war, a very long war, but it quite surprised me how short it was.
Well, Secretary of State James Baker's in the Middle East now, and he'll soon be visiting Israel. President Bush is calling for an end to the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Do you welcome American involvement in trying to get resolution?
Absolutely, yes. I think right at the moment there is no substitute for America's role as an honest broker between Israelis and Arabs in general, Israelis and Palestinians in particular.
Now, I know you are opposed to linkage, but we're for reconciliation with the Palestinians. Where do you stand now on an international peace conference?
I don't mind an international auspices for the opening of the conference, but at a very early phase, this ought to become a direct Israeli-Arab-Israeli-Palestinian dialogue, or else it is not really a peace process, it is a performance.
What do you mean?
Well, if it is an international conference where the Arabs would not talk to Israel because Israel is some kind of a pariah, they will talk to the brokers and the brokers will have to talk to the Israelis, I will not regard this as a genuine peace attitude on the part of the Arabs. They will have to talk to us. There is a certain point when parties have to stop saying to each other, talk to my lawyer, if they really mean peace.
One of the accusations the Palestinians always make is that even when the Israelis say they're willing to talk, they won't talk with Arafat, they won't talk with the PLO, and they use that as a reason to not talk to anybody. Who do you think Israel should speak with as representative of the Palestinians?
I believe Israel ought to talk to any Palestinian leader or leadership whom the Palestinians regard as their authentic leadership, whether we like those people or not. I don't think the Israelis have the right to veto the Palestinian leadership, just as the Palestinians don't have the right to veto the Israeli leadership. In short, Israel ought to talk to any Palestinian leadership who is willing to explicitly recognize Israel's right of existence and renounce the ideas about extermination of Israel.
Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO, lost credibility in a lot of people's eyes because of the way he sided with Saddam Hussein. Would you be any less willing to see him as a representative of the PLO? He remains...
Look, I'll put it very bluntly. Yeah. If I was a Palestinian, I would not vote for him, but I am not a Palestinian. And as long as the Palestinians seemingly do want him as their leader, we ought to talk to him. I presume many Palestinians are not particularly happy to see Mr. Shamir as the leader of Israel, but it's not up to them to decide. In short, I think the two national leaderships, the Israeli government and the Palestinian national leadership, whether I like it or not, and I happen not to like it, those two have to talk business. The name of the game is make business, not necessarily make love.
Israelis spent the war going in and out of their sealed rooms, putting on and off their gas masks. Palestinians spent the war in their houses under curfew, able to leave just a few hours a week. Did you think the curfew in the occupied territories was justified?
Well, if the alternative was mass riots, very violent pro-Iraqi riots, and the loss of many, many human lives, Palestinians and Israelis, then in general terms, I'd say yes, policy was the policy of curfew was the lesser of many evils. I think it might have been worse were it not for the curfew. Of course, it's a very grim measure. But the Palestinian people were not exactly spending all their time in their curfewed homes. They were sometimes dancing and cheering on the roofs at the sight of the Iraqi missiles flying overhead to land in Israeli cities. I imagine it that if those masses would have been allowed to crowd in the streets and form very massive, violent demonstrations, there would have been losses of human lives. So the curfew might have been, in the end, the lesser of many evils.
But how does a democracy justify that kind of treatment of so many people? I mean, even if there are some people who would have tried to lead violent actions, the whole population pays the price.
You are now transplanting an American concept of a civil rights issue into an international conflict. There is a democracy in Israel. There is, let's face it, no democracy in the occupied territories. This is contradiction in terms. There is no such a thing as democratic occupation. Those occupied territories have been for a very long time under military administration, under court-martial. There is no way of reconciling occupation and civil rights. Even the most tolerant, liberal, well-meaning military occupation is still a military occupation. And the way to terminate the conflict is not to make it more rosy or more permissive or more civil rightsionist. The way to terminate the occupation is to terminate the occupation. Let the Palestinians decide their political destiny. There is no such a thing as military occupation combined with democracy. And the occupied territories are not democratical in any sense.
Did you have many Palestinian friends who were living under curfew during the war?
I've been talking to many of them over the telephone during the war. And of course, there were a lot of tension, including personal friends who bitterly disagreed with Israel, with Israel's policy. And there was a lot of bitterness on my side for the more or less general endorsement of Saddam Hussein by Palestinian people. Despite the bitterness, of course, personal relationship continue. We talk, we chat, we joke about our disagreements. We have reached this phase, some of my friends and myself. And, you know, in the middle of a tragedy, sometimes you get a good laugh. Even that may happen.
Well, looking at your world as a little microcosm, I'm wondering if things became harder to talk about as a result of the war and as a result of the curfew and the Scud missile attacks. I mean, you're part of a group that's probably made some of the most real progress in discussions between Israelis and Palestinians. And I'm wondering if you feel further apart from the Palestinians who you're used to discussing with than you did before the war.
You see, in the short run, I think the Peace Now cause suffered a setback. Just before the beginning of the Gulf crisis, in August last year, some 42 to 43% of the Jewish section of Israel were willing, according to public opinion surveys, to consider a two-state solution under certain provisions, which is the Peace Now concept. I suppose now the rate is lower for anger, rage, and mistrust. In the long run, I am sure we are going to recover because the Palestinians have learned a very sobering lesson and the Israelis have learned a very sobering lesson. The Palestinians have learned that no fiery messiah is going to emerge from the east in the shape of a new Saladin, of a new Saddam Hussein, and free them of the need to compromise with Israel. The Israelis, for their part, might have learned that in the age of ballistic missiles, buffer zones are not that crucial for national defense. At least they do not provide for comprehensive national defense, as some Israelis used to assume, that the buffer zone will give them a kind of cushion, a kind of insurance against any aggression. This is a sobering lesson for both, and I hope in the long run, I don't know how long, both Israelis and Palestinians will return to the only possible solution, which is a sad, inconsistent compromise manifested by a two-state solution. Israel for the Israelis, Palestine for the Palestinians. No one gets nearly as much as one thinks one deserves.
Are there new divisions within Israel after the war?
I don't know. I think every possible division already exists
right.
In Israel. The nation is as divided as it is. We are 5 million citizens, 5 million prime ministers, if not 5 million self-fashioned prophets and messiahs. How much more divided can you get?
Do you feel that you were changed in any way?
No, I may have grown a little more sad than I have been before this war. But then I grow a little more sad with every war in the Middle East. And I've seen too many of them.
You have a new novel, and I want to talk with you about it, but first let's take a short break. And my guest is Israeli writer Amos Oz, and after the short break, we'll talk about his new novel, To Know a Woman. This is Fresh Air. Israeli writer Amos Oz is my guest. Many of your novels have been, well, really, really pretty political, exploring the issues that divide your country. And your new novel, I think, is a much more personal book, a much more character-oriented book.
Yes, it is perhaps more introvertic and more of chamber music than my former novels. But even that in a very troubled part of the world, even that in itself is some kind of a political statement, namely an attempt to opt for private life. The antagonist, the hero of this novel, is a retired secret agent, in fact a very senior secret agent with the Israeli Secret Service, who makes the rather far-reaching decision for an early retirement. He opts for an early retirement and decides to devote his entire time to his family and to his private affairs.
And is this something you identify with?
Up to a point, of course. If I would identify with my character all the way, I won't write the novel. I'd be him.
Do you, as a writer, identify with a secret agent in any way?
Well, that's a good question. I think a secret agent is an interesting metaphor for a storyteller. You see, you have to be, both as a secret agent and as a writer, you have to be very detached, very cool, at the same time very imaginative, capable of putting yourself in other people's shoes, sometimes under other people's skins. You have to assume different identities. You have to have a very sharp eye for detail. You have to look for patterns connecting seemingly disconnected details. All those things secret agents and storytellers must have in common.
Can I ask you to read a paragraph from the book that I think might show the connection that you're making?
He had never raided a safe house, tailed anyone through a maze of alleyways, wrestled with tough guys, or planted listening devices. Others did that. His business was to establish contact, to arrange and prepare meetings, to allay fears and lull suspicions without dropping his own guard, to convey to his interlocutor a relaxed, good-humored intimacy, like an optimistic marriage counselor, and in the meantime to penetrate sharply and coolly under the stranger's skin. Was he a fraud, an amateur fraud, or an experienced, cunning deceiver, or perhaps merely a petty crank? A German overwhelmed by historic guilt, a world-reforming idealist, a deranged person sick with ambition, a trapped woman bent on a desperate act, an over-enthusiastic diaspora Jew, a bored French intellectual hungry for excitement, or simply bait cast at him by a hidden adversary chuckling somewhere in the dark, or an Arab driven to the other side by lust for revenge against some private enemy, or a frustrated inventor with no one to appreciate his genius. These were the crude headings. Behind them lay the really complex and delicate work of classification. Always and without exception, Yoel insisted on deciphering the person opposite him before he would take so much as a single step. So, as you can see, there are certain similarities.
Do you feel in a way that you've gone undercover to write some of your fiction?
Well, there is part of me which always lives undercover. The way I observe people, even when I conduct a conversation, there is part of me which just listens and watches and gathers details, always. This is the untrustworthy element in the personality of a storyteller. Always gathering, putting together some petty thefts, you know, pickpocketing a gesture, stealing an expression, memorizing a manner of speech or a cliché in a conversation. Never trust storytellers. They always take something away from you without you noticing it.
Now, the character in To Know a Woman, has just retired from the intelligence service. And you, I believe, are of the age where you're no longer in the reserves.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make a big difference to you, or in the way you reacted to crises, or in the way you looked ahead and saw your future?
To be very precise, I'm still in the reserves, but no longer in the combat unit, for which I'm too old now. But no, it had not made a major change in my life, except for the obvious changes of middle age. And in some respect, the novel is about middle age. It's a novel about a person changing his set of priorities in a very radical way. A person who decides that things that were frightfully important to him before, his career, his ideas, his devotion, are less important now, and things that were minor and almost insignificant to his life before are now very central in his life. This is an experience which, to some extent, I do share with my protagonist here.
Now, I know you're working on a new novel, and I believe the subject is the Intifada. Can you tell us a little more about that novel?
Two minor corrections, or not so minor. A, this new novel was just released in Israel 2 weeks before the Gulf War began on January 1st.
Oh, I see.
It's called The Third Condition. Now, it's not about the Intifada, and I'd never dream of writing a novel about the Intifada. It's set against the background of the Intifada, and the protagonist in that novel, a fussy Jerusalem intellectual, is forever tormented by the Intifada. But the Intifada is in his mind and not so much between the pages of the novel. There is not a single episode, Intifada episode, described in the novel. It's entirely in the tormented mind of a rather moving, I believe, Jerusalem intellectual who cannot help feeling personally responsible, if not personally guilty, for every single moment of the suffering on the West Bank, on Gaza, and in fact everywhere else in the world.
Feels guilty, but?
Feels guilty, but incapable to do anything, except writing letters to the editors. Except trying to pacify his most immediate, the most immediate people around him. He works as a receptionist in a gynecologist clinic, probably for guilt, trying to pacify the female sex for what he regards as a perpetual and everlasting injustice inflicted on women by men. So he's always in the business of trying to make good or to correct an injustice for which he is not personally responsible.
Is guilt an obsession of yours?
I'm fascinated by guilt. I think it's not only an obsession of me, it's part of the Jewish heritage and Jewish civilization. Guilt, shame, responsibility. And I'm, in a way, I'd say I'm proud of being capable to be ashamed of things. And I'm very critical of civilizations where guilt, responsibility, or shame are regarded as weaknesses.
I don't think I've ever asked you how you became a part of Peace Now. You were one of the founders of it. I imagine you were a writer first.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you became a part of it, how the group was formed?
Well, I was involved in peace activities long before the group was formed. Peace Now really was established as late as 1978, on the eve of President Sadat's historic visit to Jerusalem. And it was started by a group of young reserve army officers who openly stated that peace is more important than territories. I joined in as a kind of a sage, mind you, I was in my 30s then or so, but I was regarded as a sage to that movement. I have been writing essays and articles favoring Israeli-Palestinian compromise ever since the 1967 war. Ever since the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and Sinai and the Golan Heights by the Israeli army in the very justified war of self-defense in 1967. As early as 67, I maintained that the occupation must be a temporary measure. It cannot be an everlasting situation.
And what does it mean now to be in the group on a daily basis? What does it mean?
Well, it means something very different than what it means to be an American peacenik. To be an American peacenik means to object war first and foremost. I would say that I'm more antagonized by aggression than I am by war itself. I've been on the battlefield twice in my life, and I'm not ashamed of that because on both cases, it was, in my view, justified for me to fight. I was fighting for my life, for the lives of those who are dear to me, and for the freedom of my country. But nothing else will ever make me fight. National interests or things like that, I'd never fight for them. Now, on a daily basis, I am not in the business of necessarily sympathizing with the enemy. I realize that the enemy is an enemy. Unlike some American peaceniks, I do not maintain that the enemy is really a friend in disguise. And all we needed is 5 minutes of tete-a-tete in a shut room and remove the misunderstandings and getting to love each other. The enemy is real. The war is not being fought for nothing. Nonetheless, this Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli-Arab conflict can end in one of two ways. Either in a Shakespearean way, namely the stage is covered with bodies, but justice prevails. This is the typical end of a Shakespearean tragedy. Or else it can end in a Chekhovian way. Everybody is frustrated. Everybody is unhappy. Everybody is deprived of their dreams and fantasies, but alive. And I opt for a Chekhovian solution. A compromise with clenched teeth, where neither Israelis nor Palestinians get nearly as much as they think they deserve, and maybe they do. Where both sides sense that there is a deep injustice in this resolution. But the only alternative to an inconsistent compromise is a glorious death. And I've seen enough death in my life to hate it.
Well, Amos Oz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Amos Oz's novel, To Know a Woman, has just been published in the United States. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.